Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio broadcast of all things culturally considered. For Alan Farley, I'm David LaTulipe. This week, a visit with composer Samuel Carl Adams, son of John Adams, who is having his work Drift and Providence premiered by the San Francisco Symphony under the baton of Michael Tilson Thomas on a program that also includes Mahler's epic Fifth Symphony. Some of the symphony's recording of that work will conclude our hour together. Coincidentally, today is American patriot and cousin of American revolutionary John Adams, Samuel Adams' birthday today. Thanks to Joe Burke for that almanac fun fact. No relation, by the way, in any way. And I'll be joined by actor James Carpenter and the artistic director of the Cutting Ball Theater, Rob Melrose. Cutting Ball opens its 13th season with the Strindberg Cycle, the chamber plays in rep, a festival of August Strindberg's five chamber plays in new translations by Paul Walsh, presented in celebration of Strindberg's centennial. So stay tuned this hour of Open Air. Composer Samuel Carl Adams joins me in studio now on this coast in the weeks ahead for a couple of performances of his works. Drift and Providence, which was commissioned by the New World Symphony, will have its San Francisco Symphony premiere this week under the baton of Michael Tilson Thomas. And his work, The Piano Trio, will be performed by the San Francisco Contemporary Players in late October. Sam, welcome to KALW.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Well, this is an exciting and busy time for you, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is very busy and very exciting.
Let's first talk about the symphony premiere, which must be on everyone's minds, lips, and instruments this week.
Yeah.
It's coming up this week. And a little bit about the work's genesis. It's called Drift and Providence.
Yeah, the work actually came after a period of time when I was experimenting, working with computer-generated noise and filtering noise in order to create harmonies. And what I mean by filtering noise is taking particular frequencies and certain pitches and thinking about music as kind of a reductive process. So what we hear is kind of a result of filtration rather than just producing things from instruments. And so I had written these two pieces that utilized this approach to making music, and then I thought it could be really interesting to write a work that used acoustic noise produced by percussion instruments, and that I could pull certain frequencies out of their spectrum and pair them with an orchestra. So the piece kind of came out of this experiment working with electronics. And then I was approached by the New World Symphony, and they asked me if I would be willing to write a piece, and I suggested this to them, and we kind of went from there.
So the live electronics approach, does that imply that there's an improvisatory element to the work in every performance?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it improvisatory. I actually write in a very highly notated and very specific way, but I have the percussionists creating these kind of noisy drones with metallic objects and cowbells and Armglocken and sizzle cymbals and snare drums and bass drums, you know, played with wire brushes in the kind of how a jazz drummer might play them. And you know, they're within a certain time period that I'll give them, you know, let's say 5 or 6 measures of music, they'll just kind of be making this very rich noise world. So there is a level of, I guess, indeterminacy in the sense that, you know, I'm specifying a certain period of time, but within that, they're able to kind of, you know, change the noise a little bit and kind of scrape in a different way and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, with its creation in Miami, I'm wondering, How were those performances, and has the piece changed at all since you're bringing it to the West Coast?
Yeah, the performance was amazing in Miami. I mean, the new hall that they have down there is fantastic, and it sounded incredible. I mean, it was just an amazing experience. The piece has changed a little bit. I've changed the instrumentation slightly. I've added more woodwinds, and now the string section is a little bit bigger. Michael wants to use the bass section of 8 basses, for example, rather than 4. So it's a larger sound now. There are some slight structural modifications that I made to the piece towards the end. I changed a little bit, but more or less the piece flows in the same exact way. It still very much is.
You mentioned Michael Tilson Thomas offering some changes. I'm wondering, he's a composer in his own right. I'm wondering if he had other suggestions either for the way it was written or the way it was orchestrated.
Not too much. He's made some suggestions that are, very good. I mean, I guess just about bringing out certain things that maybe were not quite as clear, during the first reading. But those changes were actually made kind of in the process while I was at New World, not necessarily in between these, the period from the premiere to up until now. So, but yes, it's been great having, a dialogue with such an amazing musician who has so much experience and knows everything, so he's given me some good suggestions.
Great. And having this premiere on your coast, your home coast.
Yes. Exciting. Very exciting. I mean, I obviously presenting my piece in Miami was a thrill, but it's so different now that I'm presenting this in front of, my family and my friends and, my teachers who spent so much time with me, helping me become, a professional musician. So it's really exciting. It's also a little bit, intimidating, I guess, being in front of an audience that knows me so well. So.
Sure. I was going to lead into that at some point. An inevitable question for you, Sam. We are, all of us, of the male variety at least, our father's sons. And yours casts a particularly long shadow, hopefully a supportive shadow as well. But nonetheless, you are composer John Adams' son. Mm-hmm. And has the influence of such a, highly regarded composer and father mm-hmm. always been a welcome one? Or do you find that people maybe have expectations to hear a John Adams light or a John Adams Jr. when they hear your music?
Well, I'm sure that there are many people who think that way. And, there are, I think, also expectations in both directions. Maybe that people are expecting me to sound like him and are disappointed when I don't. And maybe there are people who expect that I sound nothing like him and maybe they're disappointed when I sound maybe a little bit like him. Of course, so it's been a something that I've obviously been very aware of. But I think that we're such different people and we have such different backgrounds that inevitably our music is going to sound different in certain respects. But I also did spend, 17, 18 years of my life with him. And so, of course, there are going to be elements of my music that are, influenced by the way that he works and the way that he thinks.
Sure. Other than the familial instruction, then either directly or indirectly having that music in your household, where did you study composition in addition?
Well, actually, I didn't study composition growing up really until I was in college. So I started when I was at Stanford, starting working with a professor there named Mark Applebaum. And I worked with him for 2 years, and then I went to the Yale School of Music, and I studied primarily under Martin Bresnik there. But as a youth, I mean, I guess I'm still a youth because I'm 26, but as a very young kid, I was primarily playing bass and piano and not actually so much composing music. So it's actually kind of a relatively new thing for me.
Interesting. You're also an orchestral bassist, I understand.
Orchestral bassist, but also primarily jazz bassist. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, I had spent up until that point in my life playing mostly classical music, and I found that improvising was actually, in a way, more satisfying. And so I started improvising on the bass, and I spent many, many hours in the San Francisco jazz circuit playing at bars and nightclubs and whatever kind of events. So a lot of my approach to music is very much informed by a more intuitive and improvisational way of thinking and not so much a kind of structured classical
sure
way.
So a lot of your jazz performing and just having the jazz in your ears is coming out in your composing as well, then?
Absolutely. And I think it actually comes out very much in this piece, Drift in Providence, which I'm going to present later this week. If you hear the piece, you'll hear that there is a harmonic language that is very close to maybe blues or something kind of jazz-like. And then also the way that I treat the percussion in many parts of the work sounds kind of like an exploded version of a snare drum. This like very soft but very noisy kind of brush-like texture that I think very much comes from standing next to a jazz drummer for so many hours.
Nice, yeah. Well, you're in good company on these concerts. Mahler 5 also on the program.
I've heard of him.
More information about your performance along with the Mahler 5, Samuel Adams, Drift in Providence at sfsymphony.org. I wanted to talk a little bit about another work of yours, that the scheduled premiere of the Piano Trio, which was supposed to have a performance at Barge Music, I understand, in Brooklyn. But just before the premiere, some fire marshals came in and shut down the place. What was going on there?
Yeah, that was a very interesting occurrence that happened. Yeah, I guess it was 24 hours before the scheduled premiere. I guess there was a problem with the fire escape, and so the venue unfortunately was shut down for a period of 3 or 4 days before it reopened.
Well, I'm glad to hear it reopened, because it's such a spectacular
setting. It's a spectacular place, and the premiere of the piece was in June at Barge. So, you know,
great.
6-8 months later. But it's a fantastic place, and I'm glad that it was able to have its premiere there.
I performed there once, and as a flutist, you know, if there's a big wake, it's kind of a challenge to keep your balance.
Exactly. Luckily for my performance, it was a relatively calm night, so no one fell off their chair during the performance.
Well, the Piano Trio will be performed in October with the San Francisco Contemporary Players as part of a week-long celebration of the 100th anniversary of another revolutionary composer. And again, you're in good company. Artist and writer John Cage's music on that
concert.
Heard
of him, too.
And those concerts in October. Late October,
yeah.
We can visit sfcmp.org for those concert information of that. And now you are a resident of Crown Heights. You bike in Prospect Park. How long have you been in Brooklyn?
I've been in Brooklyn just a little bit over 2 years now. And it's a very exciting place to be. There's so much creative activity all throughout even just that borough. So much so that half the concerts, maybe even on some weeks, more than half the concerts that I attend are in Brooklyn and not necessarily Manhattan or elsewhere in the city. It's just a very exciting and lively place to be. And so I'm really happy to be there. So.
But still a West Coast boy at heart?
I think so, yeah. It wasn't really until I moved to Brooklyn that I realized how much of a West Coast thinker I was. But I think it's healthy for me to be in New York right now, and being part of that dialogue is refreshing and exciting.
Different places to bike in Brooklyn, I imagine. Prospect Park, yes. Have you done any other traveling around on bike?
I did a Century, which is a 100-mile bike ride out through New Jersey earlier. I guess that was last year, about a year ago. I go into the city and ride the Central Park circuit and the Coney Island circuit as well. So
nice.
Both my roommates are bikers. So
All right.
We try to get out and get some exercise occasionally.
Way to go. Go Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I made my home in Park Slope for many years and really enjoyed it out there.
It's a great place to be.
Especially this time of year. Mm-hmm. It's just this magical time to be in New York, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, there'll be lots of more information that you can get on Sam Adams' music at his self-designed website, SamuelCarlAdams.com. What music of yours would you like to share with us today?
Well, I would like to share excerpts from my two tension studies, which were commissioned by a San Francisco-based group called the Living Earth Show, comprised of Andy Meyerson, who's a percussionist, and Travis Andrews, who is a guitarist. And they asked me to write this piece 2 years ago, and we recorded it actually in this neighborhood at a place called Tiny Telephone about a year ago, and we've been working on the production of it since then. And these pieces deal with this idea of kind of filtered noise, which I had mentioned earlier. And they were the first two pieces actually that I wrote after I finished school. So there is, I think, actually kind of a very intuitive and maybe more emotional aspect to these pieces that hadn't really existed in my work up until then. Andy and Travis play them often in San Francisco, so if you like them, and you can check out the information on my website, I'm sure they'll be playing them again soon.
Okay,
so.
And the name of the work again?
Tension Studies. So these are excerpts from Tension Study Number 1 and Tension Study Number 2.
Music of Samuel Carl Adams here on Open Air.
Thank you.
Tension Study No. 1 by composer Samuel Adams. And here's a brief excerpt from his Tension Study No. 2. Brief excerpt of Tension Study No. 2, music of Samuel Carl Adams, my guest here on Open Air. I'm David LaTulipe. Sam's orchestral work, Drift and Providence, has its premiere this week with the San Francisco Symphony. Now, due to broadcast restrictions, we're not able to offer an excerpt of that work this afternoon. But, Sam, what other music did you bring today?
There's also a piece that I'd like to present called Piano Step, which is for solo piano, which is actually a very different work, very, very much different from Tension Studies No. 1 and 2, that was commissioned by Lisa Moore, who's a New York-based pianist and a frequent collaborator of mine. And this is a piece that she premiered 2 years ago in 2010 that is a kind of wild and frenetic and, I guess, more jazz-influenced work that I wrote for her. This is Piano Step.
Music of Samuel Carl Adams. an excerpt from Sam Adams' Piano Step. Piano music composed by composer Samuel Carl Adams. You can learn more about his projects at samuelcarladams.com and see the schedule of this week's concerts with the San Francisco Symphony at sfsymphony.org. In addition to Sam's Drift and Providence premiere, Mahler's Fifth Symphony on the program. We'll hear the finale to conclude today's broadcast after another studio visit with some folks from the Cutting Ball Theater. You're listening to Open Air on KALW. I'm David LaTulipe. This is Open Air on KALW, your local public radio stations, funded by listeners like you. Thank you for making our fall membership drive such a success. I'm David LaTulipe in for Alan Farley. Pleased to welcome back to the KALW studios two gentlemen who are no stranger to the airwaves of KALW, actor James Carpenter and the artistic director of the Cutting Ball Theater, Rob Melrose. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, David. It's great to be back.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Well, I understand you gentlemen collaborated in 2010 at the Black Box Theater. Mm. Can you tell me something about that collaboration?
It's a play by Trevor Allen based on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It was called The Creature, and Jim was the creature. He was Frankenstein's monster. It was three people. And it was a big success for us and a wonderful collaboration.
We'd done it as a reading at the Magic Theater on Halloween previous 2 years, so I kind of had a baseline character already, which was nice.
Was this the first time you guys collaborated?
Yes, it was. We'd not worked together before. We knew of each other's work, and Trevor Allen, was it Trevor that brought you in on the project?
Yes, absolutely.
And Rob was a great eye out there for us. But it was almost like we had a play to start with already. Mm. You know, I had the voice and did some work to deepen it and lower it so that I could get down into this range that was... Pretty spooky.
Well done, sir.
Why, thank you. I had to do some really thorough vocal warm-ups to get there, but it was fascinating. Yeah. It was a really wonderful project.
It was pretty spectacular performance. You know, people talked about it for a lot, and Jim had a way. I'm gonna out my wife on this. That she said the thing that was amazing is that Jim was able to be both, you know, horrifying, a monster, but also extremely sexy at the same time. He was a very, very sexy, sexy monster.
Well, thank you, Dave.
That's fantastic. Well, that was the original intent of the monster. It became a monster. It wasn't a monster originally.
No. Jim brought amazing humanity to the character, and Trevor did a brilliant job of with just three actors kind of mixing the voices and finding how the stories of the three main characters kind of echo each other. It was really beautiful.
I guess this led to this collaboration now, which is at the Cutting Ball, the Strindberg Cycle, the chamber plays in Rep in celebration of the 100th anniversary of Strindberg's death, I guess, commemoration. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time that all five of these chamber plays will be performed together in any language.
Yeah, we We have one over Ingmar Bergman, so that's to have anything over Ingmar Bergman is pretty damn good because he's I think he's amazing. But he directed Ghost Sonata four times, but he never no one's ever done all five together. No one's ever had the chance to sit and watch all five in one sitting with a single company.
I have to confess some ignorance about August Strindberg. I'm wondering if you could educate not only myself but our radio audience that might not be familiar with Strindberg and what is his importance in theater.
He's kind of an amazing guy because he, along with Chekhov and Ibsen, are kind of the pioneers of realism in the theater. So he wrote plays Miss Julie and The Father, and you know that alone is enough for him to be one of the fathers of modern drama. But what's exciting is after kind of initiating realism in the theater. And asking for things like a real kitchen on stage and asking for pots and pans and asking for behavior to be not, stylized to declaiming, but actually he wanted kind of real human behavior that you almost a scientific observance of human nature. But then he went on and said, now he's done that. Now he wants to experiment. And he said, what if we did plays that were like dreams? And he wrote a play called A Dream Play. And Ghost Sonata is very much like a dream play as well, where anything can happen. And the expressionists, the German expressionists, looked to Strindberg's plays, 20 years later, to come up with expressionism, but it was kind of based out of Strindberg's experiments, and he experimented throughout his career. And he was a novelist, a poet. He was a botanist, a chemist. He was a musician. He's a Renaissance, probably one of our last Renaissance men.
Do these chamber plays all date from a particular period?
Yes, at the end of Strindberg's career, he's Swedish, and he spent most of his life in continental Europe, around the turn of the century when a lot of exciting artistic movements were happening. At the end of his career, he moved back to Sweden, and they built a theater for him called the Intimate Theater, and the idea was it was going to be a theater where they would only do Strindberg. And one of the things they asked him to do is they asked him if he'd write some plays for this theater. And he was very excited about this idea because a lot of the stages at that time were huge. And it meant that the acting style had to be kind of fake. And people were just starting to make intimate theaters around Europe and then this one in Sweden. And he wrote a whole book called Open Letters to the Intimate Theater about the kind of acting style he was interested in. And he which is being very intimate and being very up close with the actor and really seeing kind of what's happening inside them and emotionally. And he wrote these five plays about the first four he wrote in a period of about 4 months, and very quickly, and they're very compact plays that are meant to be performed kind of up close. He kind of thought if his other plays are symphonies, then these are his chamber pieces. And we've got Jim here. I want him to talk a little bit about what it's like acting these, because they're kind of special and they've got unique challenges.
That's Rob Melrose, who is artistic director and co-founder of the Cutting Ball Theater, now directing the Strindberg cycle at Cutting Ball. James Carpenter is also in studio. James, please tell us about your experience with Strindberg and his work.
Well, my experience with Strindberg to date has been pretty marginal. I did a production of The Father when I was 27, playing The Father, and had no idea what I was doing, and am very glad. I have no clear recollections of performing it because I'm sure it would be painful. But attacking these pieces it's been a real challenge. Each one of them has a very distinct personality. Each one of them has a different tempo and rhythm to it. And they're kind of similar in that they're mysteries to some extent, and unraveling them and picking them apart is proving to be alternately easy and hugely difficult. Some of them have just come to me naturally, with I just instinctually felt a direction to attack the piece from, and others have been like pulling teeth. And they all have different personalities. The Burned House is like a really, really well-written Twilight Zone episode. there's also a vein in each one of them of unreality to a greater or lesser degree. The diaphragm between reality and unreality kind of wavers. And
well, that kind of piqued my curiosity. How tell me a little bit more about the Burned House and this Twilight Zone atmosphere that's created.
Well, you in Burned House, you start out at the top of the play with a fire has just happened, and people are picking through the rubble, and two of the town's characters are talking, and you get little bits of information from all these people who come into the scene. And the house belonged to a dyer who had a brother who has been in America for years, presumed dead. And he shows up, and he's just called the stranger. And it is a mystery story. It's an exploration into memory and past life. You don't know if this guy is dead, if he's alive. You don't know if the characters in the play are, in fact, in some kind of purgatory that they are working their way through. It's a very interesting little piece. I really love it. I think there's some beautiful
and there seems to be an ongoing theme of that. And there's another one of the chamber works is called The Ghost Sonata. So there's another.
True. You want to talk about that one, Ron?
I will. One of the things that's cool about this series is that people do Ghost Sonata, and people sometimes do The Pelican, but the other three plays, Burned House, Storm, and Black Glove, are almost never done. And as you can tell, Jim and I think Burned House is amazing, and I'm also a huge fan of Black Glove. So getting the chance to do these plays is pretty fantastic. Ghost Sonata, Duren Mott, a great recent playwright, said all modern drama comes out of Strindberg, and modern drama has never progressed beyond the second act of Ghost Sonata. So to get an idea of how far out there Strindberg was, that we feel like, that contemporary playwrights still feel like we haven't caught up with them is pretty amazing. It's almost like his Divine Comedy. It's almost like there's an Inferno, a Purgatorio, and a Paradiso, but with Strindberg, nothing is as it seems. So, also in Ghost Sonata, it started with a fire or a building that's collapsed. A heroic student has been up all night. We've talked a lot about 9/11 and the first responders. He's been a first responder, saving people all night, and his eyes are. His eyes have ash in them, and he asks a milkmaid to help bathe his eyes in the fountain. And a man named Hummel is in a wheelchair across the way. And to Hummel, he thinks he's talking to the air, and says, "Who's he talking to? Is he crazy?" And we find out later that the milkmaid is a ghost, and we're led from the street into this gorgeous house. And inside the house, on the outside, it's a beautiful house, but on the inside, it's kind of a chamber of horrors. There's a woman who's a mummy who's in a closet who lives in a closet, and she thinks she's a parrot, and so she talks like a parrot. And after we
touch of Beckett,
Beckett was very influenced by this play.
Jim, you are a part of a cast that involves Carl Holvik Thomas, Paul Garrier, Caitlin Louchard, Danielle O'Hara, Robert Parsons, Gwyneth Richards, David Sinaiko, several others. Now, are you doing multiple roles for these chamber works?
Yeah, I'm in four of the five, in substantial roles in those four, and I think we've figured out that the roles together compounded are larger than Hamlet. So, I am gobbling lines on a daily basis.
And, good for you.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we're in really good shape, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm very pleased with the way some of this stuff has been going, but it's, each one is a piece in and of itself, but there is, to quote one of the characters, there's a thread running through it, and that thread is very similar on some notes, so...
It sounds appropriate that these are happening during the month of October as well. A little spooky element going on.
There is.
Well, it's fantastic. The Cutting Ball Theater presenting the Strindberg Cycle, the chamber plays in rep now, October 12th through November 18th. For more information, visit cuttingball.com or call 415-525-1205. Gentlemen, the time, it does fly.
Yes. And I should say before we go that there are new translations by Paul Walsh, and that the whole project has been supported by the Barbara Osher Pro Socia Foundation, and without them, we would not be able to do this enormous project, the biggest project Cutting Ball's ever done. It's kind of like our ring cycle, so we're very grateful to them, and it's an exciting thing we're taking on.
Nice. Rob Melrose is an artistic director and director of these plays, of the Strindberg Cycle. Thanks for taking a little time today. As James Carpenter, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Again, more information at cuttingball.com. As promised, to conclude today's broadcast of Open Air, more of the San Francisco Symphony Concert sneak peek, audio sneak peek, that is. Here is the final movement of Mahler's Fifth Symphony presented this weekend as part of the San Francisco subscription concerts under the baton of Michael Tilson Thomas. This is a recording of the San Francisco Symphony doing the fifth and final movement of Mahler's Fifth. The concerts this weekend also feature Samuel Carl Adams' premiere of Drift and Providence. Thank you. The finale of Mahler's Fifth Symphony, which can be heard this weekend with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. Their recording can be found also at sfsymphony.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. The time is 2 o'clock.
BBC World Service, this is Roger Hearing with NewsHour.